Take a network break. Welcome to episode 32 of the Network Break. Grab a coffee, a donut, and join us for analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. And let's jump into the news. Bluecoat is going to be acquired by Bain Capital.
Which is surprising, right? Because previously it was owned by Thoma Bravo. And Thoma Bravo is one of these closed asset, what do they call them? Rent extraction businesses. I might be being a little bit harsh. But if you can imagine, what they do is it's like they take these businesses, get rid of all the product development and the marketing engines and just wind them back and then just extract rent from the existing people who buy it.
Right.
Similar sort of model to what Computer Associates have done. But every now and then, Thoma Bravo throws little bits of it back to the seagulls. Like, for example, they bought Riverbed. And then they sold the load balancing component of Riverbed, the Zeus load balancer as it was 3 or 4 years ago, off to Brocade, which is fast rent extraction. I just think it's interesting. Bluecoat is one of those things which is a security appliance. It's a proxy server, sits in the data stream. It's very well embedded in many, many big corporate companies because it's very fast and high speed. But it's increasingly competitively being under threat by companies like Barracuda and many others. So it makes sense to get rid of it any time now. And probably because of the fashion for security, Bain Capital thought, ooh, toys.
Yeah. My impression of Bain Capital as a private equity company is the game is, you know, strip it for parts, lay off a bunch of people, load up the company with a lot of debt, shine it up, and try to sell it back to the market.
Mm. Fair summary. Can't disagree with that. I think Bluecoat does need some love. Like, it used to be very good, and they were actually sort of progressing. Their product was actually moving ahead. But last time I used it, which wasn't too long ago, it still has a Java front end. I mean, Java. In 2015, and no plans to replace it. Still runs a custom kernel. Everybody else runs a Linux. Has a whole bunch of pain around it. So it could really use some love and care and attention to move it forward because it's not keeping up, I would say.
Yeah, I can't imagine that Bain Capital is going to give it any love and attention in the manner that it would require.
Well, they might. It'll make it more attractive for as a security tool if it has a product strategy in the future.
Yeah, I guess I feel like that's not what Bain does, but Thoma Bravo did well on it, though. They acquired Bluecoat for $1.3 billion. They're selling it for $2.4 billion, so it came out $1 billion for their pain.
Yeah, sweet. And they got rent out of it for the 2 or 3 years that they owned it.
Yeah, yeah, not bad. Hats off to Thoma Bravo. Yeah, really. I wouldn't mind collecting $1 billion in rent. I could do some stuff with that.
Yeah.
I think you're right, though, that the security is hot. So I'm sure Bain sees an opportunity here where they can polish the apple a bit and maybe come out with $2 billion for their troubles. Who knows?
Exactly. Well, then enterprise is notoriously slow to change, as we know. But and this is why, you know, Checkpoint Files and Bluecoat proxies are kind of like in one breath.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's the basic value of it. Is it if you're a Fortune 500 FTSE 500 company, you're probably running a Bluecoat proxy to look at what all your employees are doing on the internet.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Ethan, did you want to jump in here? Or?
Greg, you had mentioned Bluecoat has a load balancer product too. Is that right?
No.
Oh, they
that
don't?
Was Riverbed.
Okay.
That was Riverbed, yeah. But Riverbed sold their load balancer to Brocade.
Yeah, no, I knew that. I was thinking beyond just the proxy service that Bluecoat offers, that there was a load balancer piece in there, and you know, I just had a thought, geez, that market's way too crowded, but that's irrelevant. I mean, if the security market is indeed hot, you know, the question is Bluecoat bringing anything new and sexy to the market? Because the security market is hot with the new and innovative stuff, which is what all the action that we're seeing from the startups. They're doing, you know, different and clever things, or at least they're claiming to, especially with east-west traffic in the data center and doing super high-speed inspection and heuristics and so on, trying to ferret out what's going on inside your data center, sometimes on the presumption that you've already been compromised.
Yeah.
So can Bluecoat play in that sort of a space and make their security product, you know, sexy?
Fundamentally, what they have is an SSL interception engine.
Mm-hmm.
It's really what it is. And so they can decrypt anything that's sort of you know, and so once you can decrypt the SSL stream, because, you know, the enterprise installs a certificate into your desktop, your corporate desktop or your iPhone or your Android browser, whatever, then once you can do a whole bunch of things there. You can start to do web security. I can see everything going through it, so I can do web security, in inverted commas. Content analysis, I can see if you're looking at naughty pictures or competitors' websites and block you from doing that or saying things on Facebook that you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I can also do malware analysis inside the SSL, which is very important for enterprises. And then do antivirus on the same thing, and so, DLP, data loss prevention. So don't
I'll
make
argue
sure
that the SSL interception isn't much of a differentiator at this point. Because Greg, if you think about some of the other companies that we've talked to, they've all got that and they don't even care. Mm. I mean, oh yeah, we can decrypt it and we got these, you know, 18 ways that we can do that. And they talk through what they are. And then, but moving on, now that we can decrypt it, what are we doing with that data that's inside and so on, as you were saying?
And Bluecoat's been doing that for a decade.
Yeah.
So they're way, way ahead on that front. That's what I'm saying. Their point for existence is that they can break into SSLs and they've gone beyond that 5 years ago and started doing DLP and malware and scanning and antivirus scanning and blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But enough about Bluecoat and enough about security. That's boring. I just thought it was interesting to see, A, the rent extraction model and the fact that, you know, Bain Capital thinks there's a security play. Enterprises, get your wallets ready.
That's right. Bain's going to make that make back that $2.4 billion.
One way or another.
All right, Open Network Linux. Big Switch has announced that the Open Compute Project has accepted Big Switch's contribution of Open Network Linux for its network operating system.
Yeah, so we've seen this is obviously an operating system for white box switches. Up until now, we've only had Cumulus Linux and Pika 8 with their PCOS operating systems as really the two operating systems for switches. And in like anything coming out of Silicon Valley, two would just not be enough. You need to have at least a startup or an open source project in every possible category. And Big Switch has contributed Open Network Linux, which is loosely their Switch Lite operating system from their big
Big Cloud Fabric
solution, pretty limited. And that's now becoming the baseline for white box switches. And it's going to be – I think that's great because now we have like a standard operating system. I know Cumulus has contributed something to it over time, but now it's in the Open Compute Project. It means that you can go buy white box and have a choice about which operating system. Up until now, if you didn't want to buy Cumulus or Pika 8 and you wanted an operating system, you got the Broadcom OS, which they ship, which is I haven't used it, but I've been told it's pretty bad or pretty grim. So good for us that we now have don't get me wrong, this is a starting point. This is the first step down a path to a stable public open Linux operating system for switching. There is a long road to hoe before it becomes a fully functional thing. But good start.
And our folks actually, you can't really go out and buy an open compute system. It's essentially just a reference architecture for you to assemble your own hardware and software, yes?
Increasingly, it's hardware that you can go and buy. So at the recent open compute project, which happened in Silicon Valley about 2 weeks ago, we'll probably talk more about it towards the end of it, there was a whole bunch of things that were announced. One of them was Microsoft contributed a server architecture that's fully backwardly compatible with existing open compute stuff. And no, it's a fully functioning server. All you've got to do is bring your Microsoft Windows or your Linux and it'll run like an x86. Hmm. And this is heading in that direction. So we're now heading in the direction of we have a Linux, you know, what Linux is to x86 servers, we now have an open network Linux for switches. And over time, hopefully it will, you know, eventually build into actually being a fully functional network. It's only the operating system, so it doesn't have routing protocols. It doesn't have, you know, they're like apps on that thing. So it doesn't have the BGP stack or an OSPF stack yet. It doesn't have an SNMP engine or, you know, all the things that you think you want in an operating system in your networking software platform aren't there yet. But we're now in a situation where we can start.
So So here's a question, because this is historically something that a lot of companies have done where some major part of what they do or all of what they do is actually open source. In this corner with Open Network Linux, does Big Switch make money? And if so, how?
No, Big Switch isn't making money out of this. They contribute it, and I think they see it as validation. If I had to guess, We could ask them, I guess. But if I had to guess, I would say this validates white boxes of into a strategy that customers can be something that they can have. And more importantly, Big Switch can take advantage of other developments that people bring to the table. So if somebody starts to build a BGP stack and there are things happening to build new BGP stacks or take Quagga into something more robust and stable, then Big Switch could have the benefits of those and put it into their product. So customers could still use the Big Switch Switchlight features for OpenFlow programming, but they would also have the ability to say, and you can still use a switch with BGP and ISIS and Spanning Tree and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that was kind of my take on it too. You didn't say anything unexpected. Big Switch has their products to make money, and they've been making money with BigTap for a couple of years or more now. And then Big Cloud Fabric, of course, is their big announcement over this past the past several months that they keep developing and doing version releases on. And all of that runs on Switchlight, the Switchlight OS, as you mentioned. And that is their bread and butter and where they're making money, where they're getting traction with folks. You know, BigTap and the I don't want to buy a great big visibility fabric that's super expensive kind of a play. Do put up cheap switches running BigTap and yep. And then Switchlight as the baseline for Big Cloud Fabric, the here's a data center in a box kind of play.
It's years away, you know, but you takes little steps. You build an operating system. Then you have a kernel module that faces down towards a silicon fabric. Today, the only kernel module available is the one for Broadcom silicon, but Cavium has open sourced their API. Intel's open sourcing their API. There's other companies who make silicon switching like Centek and others who are bringing those to this. And this now means they could ship an API ready for Open Network Linux and contribute it to the project, and then their switches have an operating system. And the more people that contribute little bits and pieces, all of a sudden it builds up. And there's a secondary set of announcements here. Just for example, Facebook, for example, announced that they're contributing their FBOSS code to Open Compute Networking. And FBOSS is their applications that run on top of Open Network Linux, which provides interfaces for operations and management. Now, this means things like SNMP and API for programming and so forth. They're still not BGP or CLI because Facebook doesn't use those things to program their switches. They have their own thing. But what they have, they've contributed to Open Networking Linux. So it's progressing. And if more companies start to come along and, you know, add to the BGP stack, then all of a sudden you've got a BGP engine for Open Network Linux.
Now, Facebook contributed even more than just FBOSS. They contributed the switch hardware design of their six-pack switch as well, if I recall.
Yes. Now, we could have a whole session on that if you want to.
but yeah.
So a six-slot chassis with four line cards, I think it was. But the thing about it is that it's using standardized components off the shelf to make it happen. So I wrote a blog post many, many moons ago about the different types of 40 gigabase. And there's a special version of 40 gig and 100 gig called that's useful for backplanes. And you can buy off-the-shelf silicon and off-the-shelf backplanes to run them. And effectively what you're doing is running 100 gig from the line cards down the backplane to a switching fabric. And use slightly different Broadcom chips to run the crossbar fabric, just like you do in anybody else. All the same design as any other switch chassis that you wish to care to name. There's a crossbar fabric in the back and local switching on the line card, et cetera, et cetera. And Facebook has open sourced that. That means, by the way, that we're probably 2 or 3 years away from seeing that in the open market. But, you know, slow but steady, white box will progress, I think.
It's going to appeal to a certain customer. I think there's a lot of other customers that it won't appeal because they just want a box that it says, you know, Cisco or Juniper or Brocade or HP on the front end, and it works. And then when it calls, they ring up and say, you know, it's broken. Make it better. Because white box is almost like the do-it-yourself movement where people who own their own homes will go to the local building supply store and, you know, renovate their own bathrooms and this kind of stuff. White box is almost like that. Hey, we want to be able to roll this network our own way, and we want to put a operating system from here on a hardware platform from there and put it all together. That's not going to work for an awful lot of customers. I would say the mid-market is particularly where that's going to be. They're just going to want to buy a network that works and, you know, and move on, very likely. The bigger the customer and the more specialized the customer requirements are of their network, I think the more likely that they're going to take pieces and parts and put it all together.
I mean, to do something like an open network Linux and talk about this, you know, like do-it-yourself home building, you've got to have the operational chops, the headcount, the skill set to be able to make that viable, as opposed to just going out and buying a package-branded switch.
That's exactly it. That's exactly the thing, because – and a lot of these skills – if your driver to run a particular operating system on your switch is because it fits into my automation, well, that means you've got those very specialized people that know how to do that, because the ironic part of doing automation, although it ultimately makes things easier, getting it all set up and making it work right is hard. And those people have a lot of skills to make
So it reminds me back when I was configuring or attempting to learn Linux in 1999, 2000, 2001 type timeframes, and you had to compile a kernel to make your own Linux work. It didn't come as a distro, right? Mm-hmm. And then in the last 10 years, 15 years, we've now got to the point where Ubuntu Linux is the dominant operating system in the cloud by orders of magnitude. It's like 95% of cloud functions are not running Microsoft Windows. They're running Ubuntu Linux. And that took 15 years. So open network, I suggest to people that, you know, you're not going to rush out and buy white box today for most people. There are some who will, and they are the people who have – they're the same people who were able to install Linux in 1999 and had the time and the will to overcome the challenges, and there are many people who are doing these things. So it's – you know, it's not – you. There's everything has a use case. The question is how much of a use case, and is it financially viable?
Right.
Yeah, when there's ease of use in the white box market, I think that's going to help drive market adoption. I mean, and it could be that the model does eventually become, yeah, we're going to sell you hardware and then you put whatever OS you want on it. Oh, yeah, you can buy the, you know, Junos flavor of white box and you can buy an iOS flavor and so on. And there's no reason all of those things couldn't be possible from every vendor. Several vendors have already demonstrated that that can be done. And just like you can buy a bare metal switch, stick a hypervisor on it, then start loading up your virtual machines – pick your hypervisor of choice. It could be the same in networking eventually, but it's going to have to be, you know, bonehead simple and reliable and predictable to get that initial, this thing is now out of the box. It's got an OS loaded and it's doing switching and routing for me. It's got to be, you know, really a straightforward thing that everybody's used to. And we're very far from that now.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, yes and no. I mean, one of the other parts of the announcements of Open Compute, I've done quite a bit of research into this, as you might have told, is that a thing called a switch abstraction interface was announced. Now, this is a cooperative effort between Microsoft, Dell, Facebook, Intel, and Mellanox, which is a fairly unlikely collection of people. And what they've done is they've said the actual – in a normal switching architecture, today what happens is everybody's writing for the custom APIs in the Broadcom silicon. But what we really want to be able to do is have more than just Broadcom silicon in the switch. We would like to have a choice. Intel has some has their Fulcrum acquisition, their FM7000s and 6000s. Cavium's got their XPliant chipset. Centek's got its chipset. And Mellanox has its X2X3 chipset, which is, you know, in the switch. And they'd like to make sure that people can use their silicon inside of these white box products or to run so other people can bring their operating systems along. And so the switch abstraction interface is a way, a common language for vendors to call networking functions in the silicon. And that is probably key to progressing the industry, but it's one of those hidden away little factors. If you want to find out more about these, I'm going to publish all of this open compute information in my newsletter. And if you'd like to sign up for the newsletter on human infrastructure, you can head over to etherealmind.com and you'll find a link on the front page there that says sign up for Human Infrastructure Magazine and you can find out more about it.
All right, in keeping the conversation going about APIs, there's another piece here, Broadcom Open Switch APIs.
Yeah, so this is Broadcom for the last 5 years has been notoriously secretive and signing NDAs about everything that's associated with even the names of the products were under NDA. You weren't even allowed to say this product and not allowed to talk about it at all. It was all secret, secret, hush, hush. So for Broadcom to suddenly say open source the APIs that you can use to write to their silicon, and you don't actually have to be a signed up vendor partner with permissions to get access to the API documentation. So up until now, you've had to be a, you know, a Pluribus or a Big Switch or a you know, a Cisco to get access to the Broadcom APIs. And this has now open sourced it, so anybody can now start to use it. Again, another sign of how we want to, how Whitebox is likely to progress gradually over time.
So what's in it for Broadcom then?
They get to sell their silicon, but they don't have to worry about an operating system or building it into a box. So while, you know, up until now, the only people making silicon has been the networking vendors, you know, Juniper, Cisco, Extreme, so forth. And Broadcom likes making chips. It makes silicon chips for baseband modems. Its share price is largely driven by if they convince Apple to buy the baseband modem that they design and manufacture, or in Android handsets, or they make silicon for in networking adapters or other range of other products. This is a new revenue stream for them, and they already make silicon. They have a company full of silicon designers who do nothing but design silicon. They've already been doing Ethernet for the past 15 years, where they've been building Ethernet adapters and then building 4-port and 8-port gigabit chipsets for low-cost switches, and they've been doing that forever. And now they want to grow into this market and say, and they're looking at the, you know, 80% profit margins that Cisco makes on a 48-port switch and going, yummy. but their business is not giving it to customers, right? Their business isn't about packaging that silicon onto a motherboard, manufacturing a chassis and pushing it out the door in a box and warehousing that across the world.
Right.
But what it can do in this situation is say, here's an API. You can put our switch, our chip inside a standard motherboard, and there'll be companies in China who will manufacture that. And there's many, you know, Acton, Quanta, you know, all those people. And all they want, and guess what they're really good at? Manufacturing it. And they can put it in a box. They can manufacture 10,000 of these switches, put them in boxes, but they don't want to sell them. Acton and Quanta aren't in the business of selling them, so having a standardized design means customers can get the same design from whoever they get it from. So Broadcom makes a silicon, manufacturers make a standard model, and then somebody buys them and then just runs this open source software and gets, and that's attractive to a large enough market to get, to make money.
Okay, so definitely more evidence for Whitebox.
Yeah, and it's not going to happen overnight, right? Everybody's sort of saying Whitebox will be change everything by Christmas 2015. It's
but it might for a select few customers that happen to do massive spends, but no, it's not going to change the industry overall for sure. Not by Christmas.
Yeah, there are enterprises buying this technology. I've heard stories of large financial institutions, household names in the US, who are buying Whitebox in their data center. But what they're actually doing is one very small part of their overall infrastructure is building into a cloud, and they're using Whitebox for that. They didn't throw out, you know, they might have 20 data centers.
They didn't chuck Cisco to the curb in one fell swoop and throw all Whitebox in there, no.
No, they took a break and they said, you know, there's a use case for Whitebox in this part of my network. I'm going to use it for that.
Yeah, which seems to be when we talk to startups a lot of the time, exactly what's happening. The variety of switching startups and SDN startups is, so-and-so is our customer. What that means is, you know, so-and-so stuck them in the lab or stuck them in a corner or tried them out on a pod. That's what that means. And now you're a customer. Right. Yeah, we get it. They spent less than $1 million with you. They might have spent, you know, a few hundred thousand.
Yeah.
And you guys didn't change the world yet, but someone's thinking about you. That's what that means. And that's a lot of times exactly what the case is right now for so many of these emerging technologies.
Definitely. You know, we've been talking for a long time. And I've been saying people have got to start getting used to the idea of rotating their networking kit out every 3 years. And this is why. You don't want to buy, you know, we used to buy chassis and expect them to sit in the core of our data center and rot away for a decade. Well, maybe that's not going to be the future because we're going to see 10 gig, 25 gig, 100 gig, 400 gig. Maybe it's going to be replacing, you know, it's cheaper to buy Whitebox because it's cheaper to buy one Whitebox than have 1 year's maintenance contract from a branded vendor. Maybe, maybe not. But we've got to think about rotating far more often. But to rotate networking kit, you've got to actually change the way you design and architect so you can actually pull it out and throw it away every 3 years instead of today where it's all mission critical, you know, business strategic every time you move or change anything.
No, that story, Greg, is definitely resonating with people. I was briefed by a vendor yesterday. I'll leave their name out for the moment, but they told me a story where they went into a customer to present their product. It happens to be a switching related product. And the customer said, if you can figure out how to help me get rid of some of these big core switches I have that are costing me $500,000 in maintenance right now, then we can do business, because it's all about reducing that OPEX to own those switches once they've got them in the door. Give me something cheaper. And then that also plays into the, it's not just the technology changing so fast that makes you want to rotate every 3 years. It's buy it cheap so it doesn't cost you so much to own it. And you also get the benefit of the new technology that's coming around as speeds and feeds increase.
That's right. I mean, look at where we were 2 years ago, or was it 18 months ago? We were talking about, Cisco was talking about DFA, dynamic fabric automation. And then ACI comes along. And now we're all talking about EVPN. BGP VXLAN with EVPN as well. Now we are in a period of transition and disruption, and we don't know which one of those three technologies will win. And I'm not sure that Cisco understands either, and they're letting customers decide. You know, if they spend money on them, then this is a successful product. We should make more of it. But, in 5 years' time, if you've bet the house, if you bet the company on one of these strategies and they fail, you're taking it, that's bad for business.
All right, moving on. The Juniper Innovation Showcase.
Juniper Innovation Showcase. I'll tee off here on this one because I made that trip. Juniper invited me out to their Innovation Showcase along with lots of other media and analyst kinds of folks out in somewhere in Silicon Valley. Mountain View, Sunnyvale, San Jose. It all blurs together for me. I don't know what street I'm on. I just show up at some big campus and it says, some vendor name on the side, and I walk into this big monolithic of cement and glass, and they sit me down and talk at me for a while. It's all the same. Silicon Valley. Anyway, so in this case, it was held in they've got some kind of a dome arrangement. It's like a gigantic tent outside. On the inside, it's got bathrooms and places to sit and a stage and things like that.
Bathrooms are important.
They are very important. I'll tell you what. Very key, especially since the quality of the coffee they served was fantastic. So people were drinking a lot of it. So the Innovation Showcase, here's what this was all about. Juniper is wanting to brag about how awesome they are, get up in front of you, flex their muscles. And in truth, they've got a lot to be flexing about. They're a huge company, a real deal with some pretty great products and all of that stuff. And so this was one of their efforts to really engage the community out there and say, look, this is what we got going on. This is what it's all about. Okay. So this was an all-day session. It started out in the morning with some of the execs, and it finished in the afternoon with follow-up sessions with some of those same execs, or maybe some of the people just under them in the VP stratus, where you could ask more questions and get more information. In the morning, the execs talked about three major themes that Juniper was all about. So if you could try to categorize technologically what Juniper is about, they are about routing, switching, and security. And that's where they planted that flag, and they built on that theme throughout the day. Which was interesting, because it's interesting what they didn't say. And it's also interesting in light of Juniper saying not that long ago, hey, basically, we're the next Cisco, Cisco's grown hugely because of all the different markets that they've gotten into, unified communication specifically. Juniper isn't in all those different markets.
Servers, storage.
Yeah,
communications,
exactly.
Video conferencing. Television over the carrier backbone.
But Juniper is routing, switching, and security. So they do match up with Cisco for the most part in that space. Not really in the security space, but they do match up pretty strong. And then they made some product announcements along the way, and they just stuck in some other keywords there. So one of the big announcements would have been about custom silicon. Hey, we built a new chip and we stuck it in. These are a couple of service provider carrier class boxes, this PTX 3000 and 5000, which are, for most of the people that are, in enterprise, you're never going to run these things. These are monster boxes that take up an entire rack at a time. If it's a 5K, it's much smaller if it's a 3K. But they deal with huge amounts of bandwidth, and you put this thing into your carrier backbone to push along, you know, terabits of traffic, just, you know, massive volume. And this big fancy chip they put in this thing has got 3D memory and a 500 gig pipeline. And so, you know, Juniper is really thumping their mighty chest there and going, look, silicon still matters. And what we can do with this chip is really awesome, and check it out. And they bragged about, you know, in the 5K, you get an 81% power reduction. And the way they got that number was comparing it to, I think, a comparable Cisco CRS-1 install that to do the same packet forwarding performance, you would have needed 5 racks worth of the product to do it. So, hey, we can do the same thing in one rack. Boom, 81% power reduction. That's a very marketing kind of a way to get the number, but it still gets the point across how they do that. Another point they kind of interspersed in with everything, and no matter if they were talking about the routing stuff, the switching stuff, the security stuff, was automation. And they didn't really flesh out specifics of what that means, you know, but they just kept talking about automation. Hey, we're good at this, and that's really important. They almost equated SDN with automation, which is not – those aren't the same thing at all. They're related. Mm-hmm. If you've got a network platform that can be automated, meaning it can be programmed, then that dovetails very nicely with a software-defined networking application you might want to run. But they aren't the same thing by any means, even though architectures love to conflate those terms. And Juniper, of course, with the Junos operating system, has been phenomenal at automation for a long time, so much so that Juniper doesn't even think about it, I think, internally a lot of times because, oh, these guys have APIs now? We've always kind of worked that way.
Yeah, you know, we've always had APIs. We've always.
Yeah. Yeah. They just take it for granted.
What do you mean? You know, it's not a big deal. We've done. Yeah. Junos has always had a big edge.
And I think from a marketing perspective, if they really, you know, beat that drum a lot harder, it would resonate very well now that everyone's starting to pay attention to it. And Juniper is still market leading with a lot of this stuff, like the PyEZ library, which is, you know, pretty new, and they're still working the kinks out of it. I'm on a mailing list that follows that. But you can use Python to configure Juniper gear that runs Junos. It's pretty powerful, and there's a lot of stuff you can do there. Anyway, you know, at the Innovation Day, automation was a big theme. And that's good. I hope Juniper keeps pounding that theme out more because they are good at it. So, you know, so routing.
So they're coming back around to focus. Now, just to set a background to that, they've had a pretty shocking year last year where they lost a CEO apparently for abusing, you know, if the rumors on the websites are true, apparently for abusing a customer. Their financial results have been down. Haven't done as well as they've been expected. Their share price has had a rocky history. They've discontinued a bunch of products. So is this – did you get the sense that this is bringing Juniper back to the fold and saying we're refocusing on what we're good at and this is where we're going to be going?
That is certainly the messaging that they were offering in response to that question, because one of the analysts in the crowd asked exactly that question. They were pretty blunt about it. I don't remember who asked the question, but it was roughly, hey, you guys have had a lot of turnover in the, you know, at the executive level. Important leaders in the company are gone. How are things? You know, can we count on Juniper to be stable? You know, is everything going to be okay? Give us a hug, please. And the four execs that were on the platform said essentially, hey, you know, who we've got here now is stable. We're refocusing and you can count on, you know, that's part of what the day was all about. They kind of made that point. And so it was a fair story for them to tell, routing, switching, and security, especially with the people that were on the platform there. It all kind of made sense. This PTX product, you know, says, hey, service providers, we're all excited. They announced the QFX 10,000 switch, which they're positioning as a spine switch. So if you're doing a leaf spine architecture, you haven't really had a full story from Juniper. You could have built it all on QFX 5100s, let's say, the new switch they announced last fall. But you couldn't build it out huge. The 10,000 lets you build it out huge if you want, gives you all the scale. And if you're going, yeah, I thought that was what QFabric was all about. Well, that is not a traditional leaf spine architecture. And so Juniper sold not a lot of it. Now I got into some interesting conversations with some Juniper folks about, is QFabric dead? And the answer is no, it is not dead, because there is folks that bought it. Was about the best answer I got out of anybody that would commit to me. It was all very hedged and careful and all of that stuff. So yeah, QFabric
is visiting hours at the old folks home are between 9 and 6.
That was the impression I got. I mean, it's still there. It's not going anywhere. They're not pulling it from the product catalog anytime soon. There are some customers that have made significant investments in it. And for all intents and purposes, it is a heck of a product. It's just not a lot of uptake, and it is unique. It's kind of – I've done some blog posts about the architecture of QFabric. It's a very different beast from most of what's out there in the space. So yeah, the QFX 10,000 shows up, and now you can do a traditional leaf spine architecture, and Juniper can go toe-to-toe with anybody else that's building a leaf spine architecture, which is all the people. Everyone's got that reference architecture.
Yeah, leaf spine's kind of one, hasn't it? I would get the vision that if you're not building a leaf spine layer 3 or layer 2 leaf spine, which is exactly what QFabric was meant to be, but it was meant to be turn it instead of having independent autonomous units in a leaf spine architecture, just have one big leaf spine as a monolithic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that just doesn't seem to fly. You know, customers have not really flocked to that strategy. It's just too different. I mean, sometimes vendors come along with a strategy that's just too different from the normal for it to be easily perceived as valuable.
Ethan, can I ask you, do you have a sense in Juniper's messaging if what they're trying to do is get new customers or keep the customers they have, given that we were just talking about white box earlier and the impact it's going to have on the market and the way it's starting to bleed off some of the folks who are willing to experiment a little bit. And then you've got, when you look at the routing and switching market, you've got specialists like Arista and others that can also pound their chests about automation and a great OS and stuff. So did you have a sense of saying, we know who we have, we're going to keep you happy, don't leave us? Or do you feel like they're saying, we're going to go and either replace folks or whatever little greenfield is out there, it's going to be ours?
So the answer is both of those things. The customer retention is important to Juniper for sure. Now, people that are network operators tend to love Juniper stuff. I don't think retention is too big of a problem as long as the iron can push the traffic forward. So mm-hmm. I asked pretty much exactly that question to the routing guys dealing with the service providers in regards to the PTX, the new PTX routers, the big iron here that can, with the new chips in it. And they said, yes, this is all about existing customers, and existing customers are really excited about this box. And then there are non-Juniper customers that are looking at this box going, ooh, there is nothing else that will do what this does. I want that. Mm-hmm. I think the 10,000 was filling a hole because if you can't build the architecture to match what Arista can offer or Cisco can offer, then you're going to be – people just aren't going to invite you to the conversation. There are customers that might not have considered Juniper before because they looked at QFabric going, no. Now there's a pound-for-pound match with anything the other guys that can build out leaf spine are going to do. So why wouldn't you invite Juniper? I have heard it said that Juniper is not going to lose a deal on pricing. And they'll be really aggressive, especially if they're going to beat Cisco to the punch. I think it's pretty common knowledge that there's no love lost between Cisco and Juniper as far as their business practice.
Yeah. I mean, no, realistically, no one's going to beat Cisco. Cisco's just got too much money and too much heft, too much. It's got customers convinced that 10-year strategies around networking is a good idea. And you should only buy your assets. And that's how, the reason that you can charge so much for a switch is because you're going to keep it for 10 years. And if you go to a 3-year strategy, that upsets the business model. Mm. But, Cisco is, it's not going to change anytime soon. The depth of Cisco's relationships with its customers are enduring and, long term. I've worked with companies who say you can buy anything you like as long as it's on the Cisco price list.
I've worked in that situation as well.
Cisco comes out with a SIEM tool or an IDS tool, guess which one we buy? It's not a very good product. It's not the right one, but we're still buying it because that's what's on the Cisco price list.
I've been in that exact situation actually. Oh, we have all the other Cisco stuff. Let's buy the IDS product.
We need the full set.
What is this?
Because then we'll get the free glasses.
Yeah. But, companies can grow against Cisco. They could take market share in a particular category or grow in a particular line. And I think part of what I got from watching your tweets and talking to you during the week, Ethan, was that Juniper is embracing both custom silicon and merchant silicon. So they've got a white box strategy around the OCX 1000 for some customers. They've got a merchant silicon strategy around the QFX 5000 family, the 5100 and 5500 for customers who want that. And they're using the custom silicon in the PTX because that's the, you know, merchant silicon can't drive super high performance. Yeah.
In the PTX and in other places, like the MX routers got the Trio chipset, and they'll talk about the value of that. And Juniper addressed that. I mean, they said it's, you put the right silicon in for the job, that, you know, that job could be power. Okay. Well, we can make silicon that doesn't have all these features, but doesn't need to because it needs to be really conservative on power. So we're going to engineer it to do that and have, you know, these, you know, core functions, which is kind of how they talked about the PTX. You know, the PTX is a big BGP box is kind of the impression I got. And that's what that silicon is engineered to do. Push a lot of traffic quickly with low power consumption. On the other hand, there's other flavors of roughly the same silicon, if I understood Juniper correctly, that has a lot more features, but might be higher in power. But then again, it doesn't have the simple job of just doing BGP and cranking traffic through the thing as fast as it can. So I agree. Juniper with a silicon strategy is whatever's the right tool for the job. And if they got to build it themselves, they'll do that. And they got that skill.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, the reason I raised that is because there was a big tweet, you know, a couple of media articles saying Juniper emphasizes its, you know, custom silicon strategy and says it's all about custom silicon. I'm going like, no, it's not.
No,
it's about both. You know?
Yeah. And
I'm talking about the media, I didn't get that messaging. If you listen to the media, you believe that. You
know. There was chest thumping about the fact that they had built this custom silicon and why, but I think it was more like, hey, we can do this. You know, we're not just, you know, I saw it more as a poke at Arista than anything else. It was kind of how I took it. But, you know, building custom silicon is hard. If you can do it and do a good job and come out with build a great product around the silicon that you built, you just took, you know, 3 years of design and fabrication and all that to get to the point of being able to deliver product. You gambled a bit, you spent a lot of money, and they did it, and they put a big box out there. And so, yeah, of course they're going to brag about it, but I think it would have missed the messaging a bit if people got the impression that it's all about custom silicon from Juniper.
Yeah, yeah. I it's one of these things about people who aren't really looking at the bigger picture, they're looking at the narrow picture. When Juniper stood up and said, yeah, we've got this fantastic custom silicon strategy, they went, hang on, all I've heard about is merchant silicon and white box. Why all of a sudden are we talking about custom silicon? And I just want to point out that, you know, there are times for custom silicon, there are times for merchant silicon, and there's times for white box.
Yeah. I think the weakest bit of the innovation showcase messaging was around the security, only because it was kind of muddy what the strategy actually was, and I didn't get to spend quite enough time hearing about it. They threw some terms around that they didn't really explain. What they did say as far as security space, I mean, and if you've been following Juniper News, you know that they divested or shut down a lot of their security products, more of the niche products, more of the, you know, host-oriented kinds of products, you know, the VPN suite and, you know, and so on. Those are gone, either sold off or shut down. I forget which bit went where. And so people were wondering, you know, what is really going on with security? You know, and I even blogged about this a bit and, you know, but found out from some people well before the showcase, yeah, we're still committed to the SRX platform, the SRX being their firewall that can be, you know, as big can be to a very small one that would be SOHO and everything in between, a whole bunch of different sizes and a virtual flavor of it as well, what they call Firefly Perimeter. Okay. That product isn't going anywhere because it's Junos. And if it's Junos based, it's getting love from within Juniper. So the question is, what the heck are they doing with the SRX platform? Is it just another boring firewall entrant? And if you run Junos, then hooray, I'll use that firewall because I have Junos everywhere else in my infrastructure. Other than that, who cares?
I would imagine that SRX is a mature product. And then, you know, what innovation are you going to bring to firewalls that is worthwhile?
And, you know, this is where the messaging for me was so weak, you know, because they didn't really answer that question, which is a fair concern. You know, they were saying, well, okay, what we're going to do with security is we're going to secure the parts of the IT infrastructure that we're good at, which is the network. That's the bit we're going to do.
Yeah.
They talked about bringing all traffic to an SRX for filtering and so on. And I heard them say that and going, that makes no sense. And I'm assuming I didn't get what exactly the strategy was, because one is talking about centrally bringing everything into a box.
Strategy, their VFW. where you put the virtual firewall into the VMware kernel and then divert the traffic off to the SRX. To some extent, it's not quite a diversion, but you can do.
So maybe that's what they were getting at. You know, and they also talked about something called bankware perimeterization, which they haven't blogged about. They haven't, you know, there's no other marketing around that, that marketing term that they've created. I mean, but the, you know, the idea was just creating very small, you know, security zones. And then how are you going to manage that? Cause you can't practically manage that. There'd be too many, you know, if it's a micro perimeter, you'd need automation to be able to manage all your little micro perimeters.
Contrail should be part of Contrail.
But they did, but they didn't talk about it in enough detail to really explain what the heck they were getting at. And in the follow-up session later with Chris Hoff, Chris did an awesome session, but it was not following up with any of the messaging. It was just a, you know, a really interesting philosophical session about security and how you deal with how you respond to certain attacks. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough time to actually ask him questions about the announcements from the morning. Well, so I mean, I was
the future
lost.
Of security isn't about firewalls. It's about content inspection and scanning. It's about, you know, decrypting SSL and ripping out payloads and seeing, you know, what Bluecoat's doing. Or it's about endpoint, what Bromium's doing about getting into the endpoint and running endpoint security or mobile device management. The future of security isn't in the firewall. I don't see anyway.
No, and I think that's probably, Ethan, what you were detecting is that they feel like they need to keep the firewall relevant, even though, I mean, it's everyone's going to have a firewall. Everybody needs a firewall. You have to, you know, it's just sort of the box you check. But there isn't really anything fun, neat, new, or sexy that you can say about it.
It might have been that simple. I mean, they were trying to, you know, build some big intellectual ideas around it, but they were just so vague in getting that message across. It was hard to tell if there was anything, any meat there or not. So
right. Yeah, and this goes back to something I thought about when we were talking about Bluecoat and security, is that, you know, once these class of products get into an organization, they don't leave. So, you know, Juniper probably has an opportunity to keep upgrading its products, and they know folks are going to buy a firewall, but I don't think they're worried about people
not having it. They did brag about, you know, in some new technology in their firewall that will allow them to crank, you know, terabits of data through it, you know, on the super high-end one that you probably pay $1 million for. So they did have a play there that was, I want to say hardware, mostly a hardware thing. I've forgotten the specifics of that announcement, but, you know, beyond that, you know, which is really a speeds and feeds announcement, it was hard to get excited about the security portfolio there.
And yet just a few years ago, speeds and feeds was all we talked about.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Soup 2T enables new line cards.
Yeah.
Oh, exciting.
So let's bring this Juniper conversation to a close and just talk about the SDN stuff a bit. And I'll make 2 points there. One is on the service provider side of things, they were talking about the North Star controller, which again does seem service provider oriented, and it was really about automating better paths through the network through heavy data analysis was the impression I got of it. And I could be wrong, you know, as far as some of those nuances. I only got into some high-level discussions about it. But it's there. It's available. There are some customers that are using it. And they say it's open. Like everybody says, everything's open. I mean, I think all they meant by that is we have APIs that are open. And so if you want to write and do something clever, you want to write some code, do something clever with the North Star controller, hey, we've got APIs that you can do that. I think that's all they meant. They did say open again, but I don't think it meant more than that. That seemed to be, you know, interesting that was out there. For some reason, the North Star controller had escaped my notice before. That was the first time it ever registered on my brain, I think. So that was a thing. And then Contrail, there really does seem to be some interest in Contrail among Juniper customers. They were talking about, I believe, 100 deployments now of Contrail, although that wasn't qualified as to that. Is that 100 deployments in production where people are relying on Contrail, or is that 100 deployments, 95 of which are in a lab environment? You know, I don't know. But there seems to be people out there using it, and they seem to be very firmly attached to Contrail as a product and committed to its development and so on. A comment I forgot about North Star. I asked, so is North Star going to be integrated with ODL, Open Daylight? Are you guys interested in that? Since a lot of service providers are doing a lot of work with ODL. And they said, nah. They didn't seem interested
it's
at
hard
all
to
in
see,
that.
It's hard to see Juniper doing ODL. They like to do it themselves in a way. Like, I could see that they want to be open, but, you know, their idea of open is BGP. as long as it's got BGP in it, then it's got to be open. They'll participate, but without it, they won't.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up BGP. That's kind of interesting. I mean, they just to close off the point about ODL and Northstar, they said, hey, there's APIs there. If someone wants to integrate ODL and Northstar, they can do that. But we as Juniper, we're not going to drive that because – nah. going back to the BGP point, you know, that kind of came up with Contrail because as I was chatting with the gentleman about Contrail, whose name I forgot, I don't have his card in front of me, but he was, he'd been involved with Contrail from the beginning and said, yeah, well, we can do things like federate with Nuage now because we're all using standards based protocols, including BGP. It wasn't the only thing that Contrail uses, but it's one of the key pieces. And he was talking about, I'm not just talking about federating routes. He said, that's easy. You can do that with BGP. That's not even hard. But federating policy. And he was talking about actually federating policy between Nuage and Contrail as a thing that would either they can do or it's coming, you know, at some point, which was fascinating. The first time I've ever heard anybody talk about federating policy, you know, multi-platform. So
I think they'll have to. I think the carriers, I mean, ultimately for Juniper and for Nuage, I get the sort of the vague sense over time that their target markets is the carriers. That's where they really want to be. And the enterprise markets are viable for them, sure, but the real honeypot, you know, the real win is going to be when service providers start deploying Contrail and Nuage networks into their backbones and start delivering virtual CPE and, you know, services out of the POPs.
Mm-hmm.
So they will have to federate. They'll be forced to by the carriers to some extent, but I remain unconvinced that the vendors in their current forms have given the carriers something compelling. They've given them a sight of what the endpoint will be. But I think the carriers have woken up and said, we can do most of this ourselves. And if the vendors are going to do this, you need to give us something much more compelling. Like Google, for example, is leading the Open Config initiative, which says, you guys aren't moving fast enough to define the data models, so we're going to do it. And that they've been joined by AT&T and Verizon. And it is, you know, like the OpenFlow Foundation that we, you know, from so long ago, vendors not allowed to join. And it's a way of driving things at a faster pace than the vendors want to move. The vendors want to slow down and make money today, whereas the customers are saying, no, we want to get to a solution today. We don't want to wait for you to catch up. We want to drive you to do something immediately. And I think, you know, Juniper is to some extent caught in that transition where they're sort of going, hang on, this is moving faster than we're ready to do. And the customers are going, fine, we'll just keep moving and catch up when you can. Come and find us when you're ready. And it's sort of like it's a tension going on. Cisco's got the same problem. You know, look at what they got with IETF and EVPN and, you know, what about Lisp? What happened to Lisp? hard to see.
Use case specific, a lot of this stuff is what's happened to it. It hasn't taken over the world. It's filled in a specific niche.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for Juniper. And I think that wraps it up for the show, unless there's anything else you guys wanted to talk about.
I think we've done enough.
I agree. Yammered on for almost an hour.
Yeah. Anyone still listening?
Yeah. Well, if you are still listening, you've been listening to The Network Break. Now, this is normally a podcast published in the Network Break channel. But if you're listening on the Packet Pushers weekly feed, you should think about subscribing. And you're not subscribed to The Network Break. This is the sort of stuff that we talk about. Now, we've taken a little bit more time today to talk about things in detail. And, you know, Mr. Banks and I have both gone deep into some topics that we would not normally do. But The Network Break is a short, sharp, frenetic walk through the news of the week when there's news to talk about. And we take some time to think very quickly about news and views. And normally it only takes 30 minutes. So if you're interested in finding out more about The Network Break, head over to Packet Pushers and sign up there. And it will also be sort of weekly. If we're traveling or there's no news, we don't publish a Network Break. We don't just try and fill in the week just because whatever. But Mr. Conroy Murray, you are the main man for leading us off with this show.
Absolutely. And if you like the show or if you don't like the show, I guess you can leave a review on iTunes or just hit us up on Twitter or at Packet Pushers or Ethereal Mind. So folks, if folks want to know more about you, Greg, where can they find you?
They can find me on my blog at ethereummind.com and follow me on the Twitters. I'm also on LinkedIn as Ethereal Mind and so forth, but who cares about that?
Ethan, how about you? Where are you going to be?
You can find me on Twitter at ecbanks, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. And from there, you can find any other social network that you might like to connect with me on, Google Plus and LinkedIn, and so on and so on.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at interop_Andrew or over at informationweek.com. And we will talk to you soon.